Welcome to the Astrophys Podcasts. My name is Brendan O'Brien, and first of all, we would like to acknowledge Australia's first astronomers, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, the traditional owners and custodians of the land we are on. This episode is produced on Yorta Yorta and Wurundjeri country of the Kulin Nation. And we'd also like you to influence your local politicians to do more to mitigate climate change by moving from fossil fuels to renewable energy sources. We're now in our ninth year of production with over 180 fabulous interviews with top scientists from all over the world. Each month, we produce two fabulous episodes. On the first of each month, Dr. Ian Astroblog Musgrave gives us his monthly sky guide, plus a unique astrophotography challenge. Then, on the 15th of each month, we publish an interview with a leading astronomer, astrophysicist, space scientist, data scientist, telescope engineer, project manager, or particle physicist, and we discover their science journey and rare insights into how they think and conduct their amazing research into exactly how our universe works. Our audio files and transcripts are available on our website at astrophys.com, and MP3s can be freely streamed from SoundCloud and Apple Podcasts. Today I'm at the Transients Down Under Conference in Melbourne, Australia, known affectionately as the TDU Conference. It's the first face-to-face astrophysics conference to be held in Australia since COVID hit us back in 2020. And it's great to see a couple of hundred delegates and invited speakers here meeting and sharing their research in person in such an exciting environment here at the Swinburne University of Technology. And a big shout out to Ashley and Jeff, who allowed me to attend and record some interviews. I'm recording in a repurposed planetarium, which is very live with lots of hard timber and glass surfaces. Today I'm here with Professor Ursula DeMarco, who is a professor at Macquarie University and deputy director of the Macquarie University Astrophysics and Space Technologies Research Centre. And I'm also very excited to be with her here on Wurundjeri land. Ursula was born in Verona in Italy, the hometown of Romeo and Juliet, and she grew up in beautiful Bologna. She left home to finish high school at the United World College of the Adriatic in Trieste in northern Italy, and then, after a brief interlude teaching sailing in Scotland, moved to the University College in London to study astronomy and stayed on there and obtained her PhD, after which she was a Swiss National Science Foundation Research Fellow at ETH Zurich, where Einstein studied, and then a Fuse Fellow at the University College London, and then moved over to New York City to be the Asimov Fellow at the American Museum of Natural History. After this, she moved to Macquarie University in Australia, and shortly thereafter she became an Australian Research Council Future Fellow, and Ursula's research focuses on the life and death struggles between stars in multiple star systems. Ursula is also a great popularizer of science. Her commitment to both original research and effective outreach is legendary, and she's been the Einstein lecturer for the Australian Institute of Physics, which will come as no surprise when you later hear about how Einstein inspired her from a very young age. And by the way, her Einstein lecture is fantastic and can be found on YouTube at tinyurl.com/Ursula18. That's O-R-S-O-L-A-18, all lowercase, the number 18. And up until recently, Ursula was also the director of Macquarie University's Association for Astronomy, including Macquarie's Observatory and Planetarium and their Astronomy Open Nights, jointly welcoming over 3,000 visitors each year. And right now, Professor DeMarco is down here in Melbourne as an invited speaker at this amazing TDU conference. And we've got hundreds of presenters and participants from all over the world bringing together the very latest discoveries in this sensational science of transient astronomy. Thanks for speaking with us today, Ursula.
You're very welcome.
So, first up, thank you. Before we talk about your current research and the TDU conference, can you tell us about growing up in beautiful Bologna, please? Oh, wow. And could you tell us about those physics experiments you did on a train as a four-year-old and how you first became interested in science and space and all this stuff?
So I'm Italian. I grew up in Bologna for the majority of my childhood. And as you can imagine, you know, this is a place full of history, full of astronomy, Bologna and Padova. Actually, my father lived in Padova, and my mother in Bologna. So I grew up between the two cities, both of which had, you know, Galileo teaching at those universities. And so it was kind of in my DNA. That said, my parents were not scientists. And so that is not where my passion came from. I think that some kids just are like that, right? They just are curious about how things work. And talking of those experiments on the train, I used to drive my mother insane because what I was interested in is if the train is moving and I am jumping in the train, do I get left behind? So what I would do, I would take cigarette butts, which abounded in that time, and I would put it in the spot where I was. And I was jumping up and waiting to see whether when I came down, I would be coming down behind it, right? As the train should have moved under me. Of course, as Galileo had himself experimented with and recognized a very long time ago, this is not the way it happens. If you are moving with the train, you are moving already. When you jump, even if you're in the air, you preserve the motion that you have when you're actually on the ground in the train, and you go with the train. So when you come down exactly at the same relative spot in the train. So I would be jumping down back on the cigarette butt. You know, the nature of my experimental self, which started there and ended there. Today, I'm a theorist. I don't do experiments anymore.
Well, tell us a little bit about those school days.
Like many kids like me, and if you go around this conference, I'm sure the story will be repeated over and over and over. I was a little weird. I was, you know, bullied, not severely, but, you know, I was the odd one out. I was not very popular with the other kids. And so I spent my school years in relative isolation, some schools being better than others. You know, my primary school was terrible, my middle school was great, and my high school was horrible. And that took me to actually needing to change school because things had gone really bad. And that's actually when I left Bologna for the next sort of the next chapter in my life.
Well, let's have a look at that. Let's summarize it briefly. After school, you moved from Bologna University to teach sailing in Scotland. Then you went down to UCL London, where you were awarded your first Bachelor of Science degree with first class honours and topped your year at UCL London. You stayed on there for your doctorate, then you flew over to ETH Zurich for a research fellowship, then over to the States for a while for another research fellowship at the American Museum of Natural History, where you also did a lot of outreach, possibly a bit like this, but on a bigger scale, I imagine. Then that big move down here to the Southern Hemisphere, and now, years later, you're still here. But could you give us the why and how you arranged that move from London to New York? This is for our early career astronomers who I know are listening. And do you want to mention that early passion for sailing?
Yes. So sailing's been in my blood. Actually, this did come from my parents. My father was a big sailor, and I sailed and was around boats and boatyards all my life. So when I finished high school, so I did high school the last 2 years in United World College of the Adriatic. So that was not in Bologna. It was an international school, was in English, was boarding. So very, very, very different. And then I returned home. I said, you know, maybe I should do university in Bologna. But after 3 months, I just hated it. I found all those bullying and horrible things. Italy is wonderful, but sometimes it can be horrible. And I just left again and I went to London. But I was kind of early on the start of the next year. I had to kind of take 6 months off. So I decided to teach sailing. And I decided in my infinite wisdom to do it in the best country for sailing in the whole wide world. And that is Scotland. Not. It's freaking cold. The wind is howling the whole time. It was just horrible. But it was a formative period of time, let's say it that way. So I conquered my fears and my difficulties, and I had a really actually good time in the end. And after that, I went back to London. Now, sailing remains with me. I own a boat. It's my second boat. I bought my first boat about 3 weeks before giving birth to my first child. I was extremely pregnant, and people couldn't believe that I would just buy my first sailboat. At that time, my husband was wondering, why doesn't she like ice cream with anchovies instead of wanting a sailboat? But it turns out it's been a wonderful experience to have a boat and kids on boats. And I have bought my second boat here in Australia. I'm a keen sailor. I invite all my friends. It's fantastic. I love it.
You go out on the bay or you go out in the ocean?
Both. Mostly in, actually it's not in the Sydney Harbour. Beautiful is in the next harbour up called Pittwater. And we have a great time. And actually the reason is not just having a great time, is also that when you sail, it's very self-sufficient. You're very at one with nature, in the sense that, you know, you're using the wind for propulsion. The water is a commodity, as everybody should know. You know, your pee and poo have to be carefully thought about because you have to put them somewhere. And so there's a lot of understanding that you don't own it. It owns you, and you should have respect.
Thanks, Ursula. So the plan for today is to mainly focus on the science, and we're going to have a quick look at your PhD. Then we'll hear about your latest discoveries and your current research. And going back, the title of your thesis paper is Cool Wolf-Rayet Central Stars and Their Planetary Nebula. Now, I also think Wolf-Rayet stars are pretty cool, but to keep in sweet with our new listeners, can you give us a skinny on what Wolf-Rayet stars are and what is a planetary nebula, please?
Okay, so here we go. So Wolf-Rayet stars are mostly associated with massive stars. Massive means more than 10 times the mass of the sun. They tend to have very powerful winds, and these winds generate the conditions to have emission lines. So these are just like bright bits of radiation in one wavelength. Now, what I did my PhD thesis on is actually a different type of star. They look identical to the observer, but it was realized they're not massive at all. They're actually very much a solar mass star. So they're usually 10 to 20 times lighter than the massive counterparts that are the famous ones. And they are central stars of planetary nebulae because the way they evolve is, so they're basically the sun, right? The sun, when it gets older than it is today, it blows, it inflates, it becomes larger, eventually loses a lot of mass. And the bit in the middle remains a star, and the bit that's been lost becomes a nebula, and we call that the planetary nebula. The bit in the middle continues to live on and change, and sometimes it develops the characteristic of a Wolf-Rayet star, and that's usually when there is no hydrogen left in the star at all, which is a bit odd in itself because kind of everything is hydrogen, right? Stars, the universe, everything. So these stars somehow have managed to lose their hydrogen. And when they do, they develop the characteristics that allow the specific look to emerge to the observer.
Fantastic. Thank you, Wolf-Rayet 101. Okay, let's follow up a bit on that thesis paper. For our undergrad and PhD candidates listening, if you need to have some inspiration for your acknowledgement section in your thesis, your dissertation, have a look at Ursula's thesis on the UCL website. I loved it. I think your acknowledgement section at the very beginning of your thesis is so cool. It encourages you to keep on reading and to stay engaged. It's very entertaining in itself before you get stuck into the science. But back to the thesis, I see that you've used spectrograph data from the Anglo-Australian Telescope, the William Herschel Telescope, and the Isaac Newton Telescope, and Hubble, of course. But I know we're not allowed to have favourites, just like our children, but can you tell us, if you have a suite of favourite instruments now that are doing the heavy lifting for you and the most productive data gathering for you right now?
It's very interesting that you just dug up that acknowledgement. I didn't even remember. I had to go back to my thesis and read. Oh, yes, I remember. So I used a lot of observations during my PhD, that is true. The Anglo-Australian Observatory ACL spectrograph was amazing. It amazingly, I'd never been to Australia. I never took those observations. They came to me via my supervisors. And ACLS was built at UCL, where I was doing my PhD, for the Anglo-Australian telescopes, as it was known at the time. Today is known as the Australian Astronomical Telescope because the UK pulled out many years ago. I guess that was a premonition of times to come. I would eventually come to Australia, but yes. I had not been there observing myself. Today, I'm mostly a theorist, so I use computers more than I use telescopes. But, of course, observations are very close to my heart, as I recognize that I do believe observation and theory do not work closely enough at this time. So I think that because I like transients, this is the topic of this conference, I like things that change. I think that in the end, the Rubin Observatory will be playing a massive role. It's not online yet. And anything that gives me light versus time, we call it light curve, is really something that I am going to look at.
Thanks, Ursula. Okay, let's talk now about one of the iconic telescopes that's producing a lot of great research right now, the James Webb Space Telescope. I found there are 2,000 or 3,000 papers referencing the JWST on the archive server, and we've got the early release images coming down. And one of your recent Nature Astronomy papers is called The Messy Death of a Multiple Star System and the Resulting Planetary Nebula as Observed by the JWST. Now, what understandings have come about MGC 3132 or 3132 from the JWST images that you studied? And what else can we expect from the JWST?
Okay, so it's a very interesting story how that paper came about. The two characteristics JWST has, which are really important and amazing for us, are one, that it sees in the mid-infrared. Okay, so it's a very interesting story how that paper came about. The two characteristics JWST has, which are really important and amazing for us, are one, that it sees in the mid-infrared. So it can see radiation from very cool things. And the second one is just bloody detailed. It's just so deep and so precise. And these two things together made that paper. But the interesting thing in the story is how we came up with that paper, that idea, that discovery, was literally on the day when the press release came out and JWST people were all showing these first five images. One of them was of a planetary nebula, what I was talking about before, this kind of the ejected gas of solar-like stars. And we were looking live. It was evening in Australia. And I see something so strange. So this object was known before. HST had taken pictures. It was known to be a visual binary. So you see the two stars, where the central star of the planetary nebula is a super faint hot white dwarf, super faint. In HST images, this tiny little thing. The other guy is an A star, quite bright, right next to it. Now, what was interesting in that picture that was being presented for the first time to the world was that the faint guy was super bright and very red. And we thought, what? First of all, super faint and super bright. And also, it's a hot star. They're not red. They're usually very, very blue. Why was it red? It had to have dust around it. It had to have a shroud of cool, goopy dust around this very hot star. So I literally emailed 2 or 3 colleagues and I said, what is going on? This thing's got a dust, must have a dust disk or some dust around it. Let's take a quick look. And so we did a round of calls with each other. And then we thought we should really, I don't know, issue a little press release. But in astronomy, that's not what you do. You don't do press releases disembodied just because you saw something on the telly. So we decided, let's do a very small paper. The data's public. Let's analyze what this dust looks like. So we started a little paper with maybe 5-6 people. Within 2 weeks, there were 69 plus me, so 70 authors in this production. We went from writing a monthly notices paper to a Nature Astronomy paper. We found a lot more. Of course, the detailed nature of the JWST showed us all these bizarre rings around the object that had not quite been obvious before. And so ultimately you discover the hallmark, and this is quite common, I must say, in Planet Cinebla, of the complexity that can only be achieved with one companion around the main star, if not more. And in that case, there's definitely evidence that there's been a binary interactions, that means very close companions, in addition to wider binaries. So there has to be, let's have at least three objects, plus the one that we see in the JWST picture, which is the visual companion, that's at least four. And then we come up with a fifth, if something is the case, then it has to be also another one. So then became the interesting death, of course, Planet Cinebla are the death throes of solar-like stars, or the messy death of a solar-like object, thanks to the action of all these other stars on the main star. And that generated the paper.
Fantastic. So that image that the public saw, did you and your teams dig into that MIRI data and use the different wavelengths and tease it out and pull it apart to find all that classic detail for your paper?
Yes. So we truly took everything that was available and pulled it apart in the sense, for example, with dust, it's not enough to say, oh, look, it's red, therefore there's dust. There's lots of data, different wavebands. And that difference between the different wavebands tells you the temperature of the dust, for example, which indirectly, given you know the temperature of the star around which the dust is, tells you where the dust is. So it tells you, for example, the size of the disk. So there's lots of information that you glean from having more than one picture, right? So from having lots of data. When your spectra is even better, in this case, there wasn't yet anything, but just having MIRI and the other instrument, I forget the name, and their bands was very, very influential to the discovery.
Ah, thank you. Okay, right now might be a good time to have a look at one of your ARC projects. You're working on that, and it looks like, you mentioned dust just before, it looks like including dust in the models that predict the behaviour of cataclysmic explosions when various types of stars collide. Now, we know that we're made of stardust, you know, thank you Carl Sagan. Every atom in our bodies is stardust created in stellar explosions. Could you tell us a bit about the dust that you want to include in your models? The title of your project begins, this is the ARC project, Dusty Models of Stellar Outburst. Now, who's in your team? What are you doing in this project? It's right there in the title, but can you give us a bit of detail about the methodology that you're going to use and basically how's it going?
It's a wonderful question. So first of all, I think we should tell what the ARC is. So the Australian Research Council awards money. It's not a lot of money. It's like a project-based money for ideas or for single projects. So you propose at some point in the year, if they're happy with it, they give you the money. And then usually you can hire one person to carry the brunt of the project with you, as in the lead CI being the chief advisor. So the team at the moment has myself and the person who's a postdoc, his name is Luis Bermudez, is unfortunately not here at this conference, and I will be talking about some of the results he's produced. The other two people are a researcher from the Free University of Brussels in Belgium, Lionel Sis, and Daniel Price at Monash University here in Melbourne. And what we're doing, we're trying to understand how dust forms when you have a binary interaction. So binary interactions is always is two stars interacting with each other and making a mess of things. When that happens, there's a lot of splashy things, lots of gas that moves out, it cools, and it appears that when things cool and they're quite dense, they make dust very, very freely and liberally and easily. Now, what does it mean? We all understand what dust is. Dust basically is a solid state, but very potentially very, very small, right? Most of the dust in our houses actually comes from skin, but the dust in the universe doesn't, thank God. I'm a little icky. I don't like particularly thinking about bodies and blood and things like that. So the dust in the universe is just basically molecules that then decide to aggregate a little bit better and become solid. We don't actually know how dust nucleates, how it forms. We have some ideas on how the pathways work. So potentially when you have a lot of carbon around, you get these carbon molecules like buckyballs, you know, fullerenes. And then maybe those are a pathway to grains. But it's not really clear. And even more difficultly with oxygen-based dust. So if you have an oxygen environment instead of carbon environment, and these are the two types of environments we find in stars, oxygen-rich or carbon-rich. Oxygen dust comes in a lot of different shapes and sizes. You have olivines and pyroxenes. Basically, oxygen-based dust is sand, right? It's silicon and oxygen and lots of other things, and it's very different types, and we don't know how to make it. So we have some ideas, but we are not really great. So how can I hope to make theoretical dust in my models when we have no idea how to make dust in the first place? Well, as always, science is best guess. So we have some good ideas, maybe not perfect, to make carbon dust, which is the easy one, and oxygen dust, which is the difficult one. And then we have the rules that allow this dust to form. So usually it's got to be cool, gas, and dense. So we have computer code. It follows the flow of the gas around these complex binary interactions. And for every location where the temperature and pressure and density are correct, it generates the dust grain according to the best rule we have. So what then you get is that you have this three-dimensional, theoretical, computer-generated smishmash object, which is my binary interaction, with little dust nucleating and growing around the place. And the reason this is very interesting is two. First of all, when dust forms, particularly if it's carbon dust, it becomes opaque, you know, soot or smoke, it's opaque. So as observers from Earth, you know, we observe the universe through light. When dust forms around something, it tends to obliterate it, to hide it, to make it, you know, dim. And so we need to understand how that works, obviously. So that's why it's important. The second thing is that when you have dust in a gas mix, light from the inside pushes really effectively on it. And so it changes the dynamic of the flow. So these two reasons gave us a good reason to get the money to add the dust nucleation pathways and the dust formation into these simulations that we've been carrying out for years. And we've done it. So we actually have done half of it. We've done the carbon dust because it's easier to do. And right now, Luis, who's not here, is actually working hard to generate those oxygen dust pathways to create oxygen dust in those environments. And so I'll be presenting some results of what these objects look like when they get very dusty.
So once you've got your models complete with dust incorporated into them, do you put it up on GitHub and other astronomers share it? What's the next stage for that sort of data?
That's an excellent question. I think there should be two pathways. When somebody is at the stage where I am at, there should be two pathways. The first one is whatever we have, which isn't very complete yet, right? We've only been working on this for a couple of years. But whatever we have, which is simulation outputs, should be put in the public domain. For other people, there's always more stuff to mine into simulation data for other people to take a look. At the same time, we're continuing. Obviously, we're doing the oxygen dust. We're not done that yet. And in terms of the carbon dust, we've only simulated two stars, two types of stars with very specific characteristics. We need to simulate more. We need to simulate stars with different companion masses. For example, at the moment, we have a binary interaction with a very specific four solar mass giant and a companion of 0.6 solar masses. That's it. So we could just do more. Like we could do, what if the companion were more massive or less massive? What would happen? So obviously exploration of parameter space is what we can do right now. And we should be doing it while also working on the next step of the project, which is the oxygen dust.
Fantastic. Thank you. Collaboration is truly the name of the game. Well, apart from collaboration, we know that science doesn't always sail smoothly, like sailing, I suppose. But could you share with us some details of a particular problem that you're working on right now that's driving you crazy or is just so fascinating it's keeping you awake at night? What's going on, Ursula?
Most of my research right now is concentrated on this type of binary interactions we know as common envelopes. They're probably the most intimate binary interactions you'll ever have. Many lead to mergers of one star with the other, so they become one. And When you describe how these interactions work, it looks really easy, right? So the two stars come together, they in spiral with one another, their orbital distance is reduced, and then either they merge, become one, or they become a very close binary with material around it. When I first heard of this, I thought this is fantastic and explains a lot of things. Let's do simulation. But the problem is that the devil's always in the details. The simulations tend to be struggling to reproduce all the physics that's needed. In this context, there's lots of things that we need to do. And one of them, I was talking about the dust just earlier. So the dust is very important to understand how the object gets obscured. But it's almost no good unless you can simulate the light that comes out of the object that we would observe and compare with observations. One of the big issues with these simulations is that although they are very, very long, and I'm, you know, when I tell people how long one simulation takes, they go, oh my God, why do you even do it? They are kind of many months to a year in one simulation in a supercomputer. And we really would like to have more resolution so you can determine what's going on in a more fine-grained way. Look, resolution is always the problem. People will always want more. But in this particular case, to understand how the light propagates inside the object and comes out to the observer, you really need high resolution at the surface. And at the surface is where it tends to be harder to have good resolution. And without the resolution that we can't quite achieve, it is, in my opinion, quite impossible to create a spectrum of the light that is good enough to compare with observations. Now, we can continue moving towards a solution, but I don't have a solution right now. So we're all working very hard and we have this ultimate obstacle that unless we improve resolution, I don't think we can do it. So it keeps me up at night because I'm feeling I'm working so hard, but there's a wall and I don't know how to either climb that wall or tear it down yet. So we're refining all our tools, all great, but that wall needs to be teared down before we can use all these tools to really get this simulation that then we'd be comparing with observations.
That's sensational. I've got a quantum computer in my pocket. Would you like to borrow it?
I think that would be great.
Okay, is that the next step, quantum computing?
Oh my God, I hope I'll be dead by the time that... So I listened to a quantum computing talk the other day by a brilliant woman. And she explained very clearly, for the first time I understood it, what the problems are. And I now know that the best quantum computer in the world is like 12 qubits, which is hopelessly little. And even that has huge problems to be overcome before they can roll it out to bigger. But, you know, I hope that within my lifetime, we'll see a little bit of what that can do. But I hope to be retired before I can use one.
We'll be talking about teaching in a minute because hopefully some of your students might carry on that work for you on your behalf. What about the nature of your non-research work at Macquarie? I can't even imagine the long hours and hard work involved. I've got an idea. But it must be very rewarding and inspiring to be leading teams of researchers and academic staff at your university and teaching and nurturing that next generation of top-class astronomers. How are they all going?
I love teaching. Possible, I love teaching more than research. I love my students. So there's two types of students that you can think of. One is the PhD students, so these are research students that you pretty much interact with all the time. And I'm really lucky. We changed department just last year. We moved building. And I now have my students relatively close to me. And they're in a pod where they all can talk to one another and they have whiteboards. It's been really a great environment. So they're doing their own research projects. And then I just mentor them. I mean, they choose their own directions and do their own thing and talk to each other and hopefully do projects without me. But I am there to just bounce ideas off and, you know, bring them back when I feel they're on the wrong track, but not necessarily, right? So I just advise them. That's very, very important. It's not like in the olden days when the supervisor told the student what to do and that's that. And the second type of student are undergraduate students. These are working towards their degree. Most of them are physicists. They're not even astronomers. And then a part of that are astronomers. And I absolutely love teaching physics. Like I am together with a colleague, I'm in charge of first year physics. which I love because I see them fresh, I see them as they arrive. And I can really, I can go to town with, enjoying this cohort that I will then see through the years. And I, at the moment, I've been teaching all kinds of astro courses. But at the moment, I teach second year astrophysics, which is great because I have enough physics to be, thinking very quantitatively. But they're very young still. So, and there's at the moment, it's the first astrophysics course they see. We're about to introduce first year astrophysics, so it's going to be the second. But it's really great to see how you can start them onto the journey to astrophysics. And I just love teaching. Unfortunately, teaching comes with more than teaching. There's a lot of administration, and that can be, it can be quite daunting and very, very, very tedious. Some of it is naturally tedious, like marking papers, but you have to do it. That's fine. It's also quite creative. And others, just the purely administrative rule part is just really time consuming.
Hopefully enough of it is offset by that magic moment in teaching when you see the penny drop, you've explained something and they go, oh, wow. And yeah, you see the understanding. It's just a great thing. Look, I know you've taken on leadership as well on a national level. Can you tell us about how Australia is sitting in the astronomy / astrophysics framework? What are you doing there?
Yes, so this is an interesting, perhaps one of the most interesting things I've done. So Australia is peculiar in many ways. It's not a huge country and it's not a huge astronomical community. Most astronomers know each other, but it's not small considering that we are not a big country. Also, about 20 years ago, somebody had the brilliant idea to create a small non-for-profit company that would handle part of the government funding that goes to infrastructure. So this is like relatively big money to build things, sometimes computational, sometimes actual kit. The company is called Astronomy Australia Limited. It's about 20 years old. It's got a CEO, it's got staff, and then it has a board. And the board is a mix of astronomers like myself and sometimes advisors who might be government people or industry people. And what we do is we administer and distribute INCRIS money. This is infrastructure for science money. It's about 12, 15 million a year, give or take. But we also try to represent the community in its interest, in astronomical interest, to the government. So the government of Australia has many departments, like every government. One of them is the Department of Industry, Science and Resources. At the moment, the name changes from time to time. And this department has a branch of astronomy, if you can believe it, that looks after a bunch of things, one of which is our relationship to the European Southern Observatory, with which we have a 10-year partnership in place. And they do a bunch of other things as well. And AAL works with them to basically support the government priorities. I have enjoyed this work very much because you see another side of astronomy. First of all, the first and foremost reason I love it is because I am very in touch with the community and I try to understand what they want and to represent that in the funding portfolio. The second reason I'm enjoying it is that you realize that while astronomy is great, everybody's excited about it. In the end, one question you have to ask, and government asks it all the time, is what are you astronomers going to do for this country? And there are lots of really good answers to that, but many I never really thought about. But now I do think about it quite actively. One of them is that inspiration and education that has a lot of outcomes in the real world, in creating capacity, in educating people for the data industry, in educating people for the technical science industry, of which we really need many. The other thing is also the translation of astronomical technology into industry. And amazingly, there's quite a lot more than one can think. And finally, there is a great deal of other little offshoots of astronomy that we need to be encouraged to think more actively about so as to really show everybody what astronomy can do besides its core business, the deep thinking, the blue sky research.
Must be hard convincing politicians that blue sky research is so valuable.
It is because they have a lot of worries, right? So government is always worried about, some absolutely massive problem, cost of living right now, the poverty, These are massive problems, and it is very hard to think of something that looks so trivial like studying the stars when you have these problems to contend with. But I think in the end, portfolio approaches are very important, and the government, of course, has a portfolio approach. So the little bit of money that looks so expensive in astronomy actually is not a great deal of money. And when you're keeping the education level of the population high and the inspiration level high and the number of graduates in all the sciences high, thanks to astronomy, you can really do something that's beyond just the blue sky research.
Let's just go off now in a very brief COVID tangent. I saw that a lot of the work you did during that peak COVID period was very productive, despite what was happening at the time. How did COVID affect you and your family and your research? And what was the impact on your physics and astrophysics community? And what were the lessons that were learnt at Macquarie University?
That is an excellent question. So some of us had it easy. I had it easy. I have a nice house. That's a big house. My children were not too young or too old, so they were pretty self-sufficient in their schooling. That was, of course, online. My husband could work from home just like I could. And so we actually didn't have a terrible time. I mean, you become very efficient because you're not traveling anywhere. I had the postdoc worked on the desk. I was hired at that time. It couldn't come into the country. So we worked remote, which wasn't great. But, you know, we do computers all the time. So we just learned to use Zoom better. However, the costs I'm now seeing right now. First of all, there are two generations of people that really did suffer and will suffer in the future. And we will suffer as a result. One is the upper high schoolers. Those kids who missed out on the last 2 years of school, and they did not develop, they did not graduate, they did not do all those important steps that you have to take in those years. The other ones is those kids who are starting university and never went to university. So my third years after COVID, I expected a level of maturity of them that just wasn't there because they'd never been at university. So there's this kind of generational gap of kids who are a little bit off and a bit different, a bit less mature in some ways, yet maybe more mature in other ways. But contending with these kids has been actually what we're doing right now, right, in the immediate years after COVID. This, I think, I don't know what it means. I don't know what it means for this group of kids who maybe it's 5, 6, 7 years thick, right? I also think the universities learned a lot. Some things were positive, some things were negative. The positive is that, you know, online can be done much better. We've learned how to do it much better. It creates opportunities for being very equitable, like conferences like this one, having an online component, so not everybody that can't travel has to miss out. They can just join in. On the other hand, we've also rested on the online very heavily. So I think Macquarie did a great job at returning live as soon as we possibly could. I certainly know that we were back in the office doing live lectures when other universities were still doing online, because why not? My son at the university I will not name is still doing everything online. He has not seen a lecturer lecturing live. He has seen only recorded lectures. And he, when he goes to lab, he sees a lot of young people, PhD students. He doesn't see, I could call, a grown-up. So I think some universities have maybe not quite come back and found the benefits to be retained, and those really horrible things of being locked up in our homes actually thrown away to return to that more personable face-to-face experience.
And very much so from my experience. My wife's a music teacher in a high school, and high schools currently are still in that post-COVID generation of students that have missed out on a lot of stuff, and they're paying a price for it now. What's happening in high schools now is quite scary.
And in fact, the little kiddies, the ones who are kindergarten and year one learning to read, those missed out too. I mean, those missed out perhaps even more. So I wonder whether there's an even bigger ripple of kids who are just, they didn't get a good education.
Yes, I think COVID's going to ripple through our society stronger than we can imagine. Okay, well, here we are. We're at the Transients Down Under conference. What have you enjoyed so far? We're still in the first day here. And what are you looking forward to apart from your own presentation? What are you looking forward to here at the TDU?
I'm definitely not looking forward to my own presentation because I get nervous. You know, I've been doing this for a very long time and still get nervous. So obviously, we just had a morning of cultural astronomy. I think a lot is still to come on that topic. It's going to be super interesting. I enjoyed very much Matthew's review of the fast radio burst. This is a very exciting developing field. God knows what we'll be next year with it or in 2 years. I am looking forward to try and understand if I can more meaningfully relate observations and theory. I notice how there's the theoretical talks and the observational talks are quite divided. That's quite normal. But I am looking to do that synergy, given that I come from a very observational background, but I moved into theory 20 years ago. I really feel my role can be that of, you know, bringing the two together for my own little subfield, but also perhaps for more in general in the transient science.
There's so many rewards for theory and practice working together. Okay, would you like to talk briefly about some of the things outside of research, outside of teaching, outside of helping the Australian government get organised with the international astronomy community? What regularly brings you great joy when you're not at work?
My absolutely favourite activity is probably reading. I don't know why, I read anything. I like fiction, non-fiction. One of my absolute joys is related to sailing. I like anything that has to do with 17th and 18th century navy, exploration time, you could call it colonization time. I like the James Cooks. I absolutely love the Lord Nelsons. Don't get me going about Lord Nelson. In fact, I believe I might be the reincarnated Lord Nelson, but we don't tell this to anybody because they'll think I'm crazy. So that is my real pride and joy. Patrick O'Brien novels, I just consume them. And particularly if I can do that either in a coffee shop, in an interesting place, or in a wine bar in an interesting place, and particularly if I can then randomly talk to some strangers who tell me amazing things of, you know, their lives that are far away from mine. So that I really enjoy.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Okay. Look, we've reached the point where we've acknowledged that you're teaching, you're mentoring graduates and undergraduates. You've got a long history of giving invited talks and seminars. Oh, and I should mention the Einstein lecture that's on YouTube. I'll get the link to that later. It's fantastic. Is outreach important to you?
Yes, outreach has been vital to my work. I spent 10 years at the American Museum of Natural History, where for half of my time I worked on outreach of all kinds. My primary role there was to work alongside the Science Bulletin team that did documentaries and daily updates and weekly updates of, you know, cool science coming up. I do give, you know, talks in the outreach world. The Einstein Lectures was a really great one, particularly because I'd actually repurposed an earlier talk, but it's a talk I've gotten a lot of mileage out of. The title is Pocket Astrophysics, What You Need to Know About the Universe to Negotiate Your Everyday on Earth. And the idea was that the audience to which I gave this talk might not be interested in astronomy at all. So it wasn't my usual audience, you know, the amateur astronomers, the teachers. It was just potentially people said, oh my God, what are listening to? So I wanted to give them some relevance. And I ended up with this talk that was actually a lot of fun to write. And then I repurposed and changed it over the years and added bits and bobs. And I gave it at the Einstein public talk. And it's been really great, actually. So it's a talk I think that many people got a lot out of.
And I can highly recommend it as well. It's just beautiful. Okay, the microphone, it's all yours. And you've got the opportunity to give us your favourite rant or rave about, well, it could be anything. It could be about the problems we face and the challenges that we have in science, in equity and diversity and science denialism. That's one of my favourite rants. Science career paths, you might want to talk about your own passion for research, our human quest for new knowledge and blue skies. The microphone's all yours, Ursula.
Thank you. We've already talked about the importance of blue sky research and how I, you know, hope that our government and all future governments will recognize that and keep it high on the agenda, because it's a long-term investment sometimes, but it's one that you will never regret. And it's one that you will regret if you don't invest that money, because at some point down the line, you'll have a huge hole in knowledge. There is no application, no industry, no innovation unless you keep the stream of basic research flowing all the time, never stop. So I guess that rant we've already had, I've just had another one, that's great. The other one that I think is very important is in the diversity in the workplace. We are in a better time today, certainly in Australia, diversity, equity, and issues where minorities of any kind can raise those concerns so that we can all make life better for everybody and benefit from the diversity that is coming as a result. So that's great. But of course, we're not quite there yet. And there's a lot of little sectors of society that pop up all the time where issues arise and where things are not smooth. So obviously, we need to continue working extremely hard in making voices heard and voices hearable, people not concerned about speaking about problems. And one thing I would like to raise, and it was raised first by the chief scientist, Kathy Foley, was that a lot of times women in my career position, so in my 50s, at a time when I could do a lot of things for others, this is a time where I don't need to do things for myself anymore, may be struggling with menopause. And that is something that's very interesting. I want to say out loud because nobody ever talks about it. And it affects a massive amount of people. So I think in the end, I hope that by saying this out loud, it encourages everybody to talk about any little thing, any problem, any condition that makes their work more difficult. And by bringing it out, bringing the community in and having workplaces recognize it, it really helps everybody to exploit every phase in life, every diversity category, to really just do science better.
Thank you so much. Well, our time's up. I've kept you away from your lunch from close on an hour now. Thank you, Professor Ursula DeMarco. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much. It's been a great joy to speak with you.
Thank you very much as well.
And remember, AstroPhys is free and unsponsored. But we always recommend that you check out Dr. Ian Musgrave's Astroblogger website to find out what's up in the night sky. See you in 2 weeks. Keep looking up. Radio 1.